Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Hi, everybody. Larry Mueller here. My guest by phone today, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And if you have a wildlife question, we hope you will join in. Here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll get you on board here. Scott Craven, is it winter where in the Rhinelander area?
Well, if it's spring, it's kind of an odd spring. I've my bird feeder is about 2 feet from my nose here in the office, and right now I've got three purple finches on it. The ground is covered with juncos. The birds have been just going crazy this morning after the snowfall last night, and it looks like a winter wonderland outside.
Well, there were a few snowflakes falling in Madison this morning as well. So, nevertheless, we had some warm temperatures in the past month, and the bird migration has kind of accelerated a little bit with those warmer temperatures.
Well, everything happened very quickly. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Monday in Madison, it was close to 80 degrees, and all sorts of things were going on. I was in Madison at that point, and the cranes were very active. The pheasants were crowing. There was lots of turkey gobbling activity, and the few people I knew who had permits for the turkey season, which opens a week from today, were rubbing their hands about the early seasons looking like they were going to be great this year. That remains to be seen at this point. But, yes, it was a tremendous amount of bird activity. Lots of things were active. Ground was thawed. I even made the foolish, probably now in retrospect, foolish decision to put a few early seeds in my garden a week and a half ago, which are probably now I should have planted rice based on what I hear you've had for rain in the last few days there.
Yeah, it was a lot of rain, and now there's snow today.
So, great.
It's perfect weather.
Perfect.
Oh, for April 4th in Wisconsin. Viola in Manitowoc's been waiting, so let's go to Viola. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I have a question about wolves. I heard that their protection was taken off recently, and I'm wondering if that was true. I am outraged.
Well, I don't think there's any need for outrage. This has been a goal of the Wisconsin Wolf Management Team for a long time, and the fact that what happened on March 12th was that their protection at the federal level under the Endangered Species Act was in fact removed. So their federal protection disappeared. That doesn't mean that they're completely unprotected and up for grabs. It only means that management now shifts, the responsibility for management now shifts to the state, to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, which is something everyone's been fighting hard for quite a long time, because this gives the state the latitude to control some problem individuals or deal with management in some problem areas where wolves have been causing problems for livestock or hunting dog depredations and other such things which don't do the wolves or humans any good at all. So the bottom line is the fact that their protection was lifted at the federal level under the Endangered Species Act should be viewed as a great success, because it means the wolf population is doing well enough to not need that protection any longer. So there's while it's true some protection was lifted, that's actually a good thing as far as wolves are concerned in Wisconsin.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for calling, Viola. Judy and Custer, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. I'm calling to get some advice on how to maintain bluebird trails. I have 7 boxes, and I've gone out and cleaned them. I did that in the fall, actually. Mm-hmm. But I was checking on them again then when in the nice weather, and I discovered a couple of things. First, I discovered that critters had been in them over the winter time, so I have to clean them out from there. I also discovered that whatever it was had chewed the holes and enlarged them, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering whether that would be a problem.
Well, there are a couple of issues. First of all, if you're maintaining bluebird boxes, it's absolutely essential that they be maintained and in other words, service, not just put up and say, I have bluebird boxes up, and they'll stay there until they eventually rot away.
Yeah.
Because at least in the case of all of mine, they are absolutely 100% occupied by white-footed mice over the course of the winter, and they will actually pack the box from floor almost to the hole level with plant down and other material and make quite a cozy nest in there. But it would completely eliminate it as a nesting site for bluebirds. Yeah. That's why most good bluebird house designs have a side panel that can be released by pulling a nail or pin and lift the panel up, and you can literally very easily clean out the entire box and then make it ready for the bluebirds again. The problem, if flying squirrels, other squirrels, or the mice, and it's undoubtedly some kind of rodent that enlarged the hole, if they enlarged it enough, then, of course, there are other species of birds that can use the box, which couldn't with a normal bluebird-sized hole. And more importantly, an enlarged hole makes it easier if there's no predator guard on the hole to allow raccoons and other nest predators to reach in there and depredate the bluebird nests. So if the hole has been compromised, it's probably best to start over again either with a completely new box, or if you've got access to a wood shop or are building the boxes yourself, just disassemble it enough to take the front panel off and go ahead and put a new front on. Or alternatively, mount what's called a predator guard or block. In other words, you could cut the right size hole in, say, a small square piece of 2x4, and then just mount that over the enlarged hole. So you effectively recreate the original diameter and have a predator guard on there at the same time.
That sounds practical.
Yep.
I have another question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned from the folks in the Audubon Society that they actually check their bluebird boxes once a week. But now I have a couple of questions about that. If I were checking them once a week, wouldn't I disturb the bluebirds that were already in there? And the second thing is, when I check them, I know that so many of the bluebird houses originally had a bluebird nest, you know, the little grass nest, and then they were taken over either by swallows or by wrens. Mm-hmm. So what do I do if I find the twiggy nests of the wrens? Do I evict the wrens or evict the swallows?
Well, you know, that's up to you. Tree swallows are a pretty bird as well, and wrens are also desirable. So if you've got those birds as well, I'd be tempted, rather than evicting them, to put up another bluebird box nearby.
Yeah.
And see if you can accommodate everybody. For the current recommendations on the monitoring and checking, and I think the only reason you'd want to do that is if you want to keep track of the success rates of your boxes over time and contribute to the database on bluebird trails. In other words, you had 10 boxes, 8 were occupied, they fledged 2.3 young per box or whatever. If you're not really interested in doing that, then the need to continually check them is not there. But if you want the current recommendations on that and you're really keen on the bluebirds, I would check at the county level with the DNR office and see if you can find out who your local representative is for the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. And they have a really nice literature packet on bluebird trails and maintaining the houses and checking them and sanitizing them and insect problems and this and that and the other thing. And I think it would also put you in touch with a group of people of like mind who are interested in bluebirds in your area, and then away you go.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Judy. Appreciate it. And on to Mary in Middleton. Mary, hi to you.
Hi to you. I'm calling about a squirrel problem I have. I have cedar siding, and the previous 2 years there's been a squirrel, and I've seen him chewing on the siding by the front planter and the front door, mm-hmm. and he has chewed away a great deal. Now, currently, I'm fighting in the planter have been mice, so I put a piece of plywood over that planter temporarily, and now the squirrel is chewing that up, which I don't care. But is it the same squirrel? This is my problem. People say trap it. Well, I've got squirrels all over. I'm in the country. Do you think it's the same squirrel coming back? And if I did trap him and get rid of him, it would help?
Well, it's very difficult for me to say whether it's the same squirrel or not. Because that behavior pattern seems pretty localized, there's a chance that it is. On the other hand, as you suggest, in that kind of an area, you could have hundreds of squirrels in the general area. The current Madison record that I'm aware of for an individual removing gray squirrels from their backyard, and this was a fairly modest backyard. The average for that person over a period of years was about 155 squirrels a year that he was removing. So the trap and removal thing, you can cut yourself in for quite a long-term proposition.
Okay.
But the bottom line is, what can it hurt if you get a live trap, place it right there by the damage, and remove a squirrel or two? You might find you solve your problem. As far as the plywood over the planter, you can solve that problem by putting a sheet of quarter-inch hardware cloth over the planter, and that will keep the mice out, and will also, there's nothing of interest then for the squirrel either, nor can the squirrels or chipmunks dig in the planter. And depending on what you put in it eventually when planting season rolls around, you can even continue the coverage with a piece of larger mesh, and the plants will grow right up through it, and the critters can't get into it.
Yeah.
So that may help with that problem. As far as the siding is concerned, if removing one or two squirrels doesn't help, there are some repellents available. These are things a garden center would carry.
I bought some spray and spray it on, and it doesn't disturb them at all.
Well, it depends on, do you remember what you used?
Well, I'm sure it was good.
Well, it wasn't very good if it didn't work.
No, I mean, it was expensive. So.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. There are a number of different products, and I think you might have to find something appropriate. I was going to suggest something that was based on a hot sauce formulation.
Okay.
Which will deter
that them. Works.
There's also a fungicide called Thyram, which is formulated into a variety of repellents.
Okay.
And I think that would help. And,
all right.
And there's another one that's a very bitter material called Bitrex. I'm trying to remember the product name for that one. But I think if you explain your problem at a garden center, there are probably a couple things you might be able to try. But be careful putting those things on your siding that it doesn't discolor or disfigure the siding and make for a worse problem than the squirrel.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I saw a woodcock for the first time, and it was had its bill stuck in the mud, and it was on turf grass.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering how rare it is to see a woodcock in that kind of a terrain.
You know, when they're coming through at this time of year, in fact, I had a report from a person in the office here that they had a woodcock actually painting in their backyard in Rhinelander here a few days ago before this last bout of miserable weather. That woodcock's probably very excited about its decision to come this far north at this point. But, you know, they should be all over the place in April. And as they're moving north, they'll turn up in a variety of locations. They like open space. I mean, the males seek out open space where they can do their display or courtship flight. And even if they're in heavy wooded cover during the day, they'll come out to an open area and so forth in the evening where they can perform. In addition, since they feed extensively on earthworms and they need open, muddy, or moist soil where there are worms, that's another place where you might likely see them. So I wouldn't be surprised this time of year to have people seeing or hearing woodcock in just about any location.
So they're just moving on.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily. There are certainly some that that breed even in southern Wisconsin, but the bulk of them are moving on to the peak of their range in northern forests.
Interesting bird.
So they are
it is.
Bird.
Thanks a lot for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Al in Lewiston, Minnesota has been waiting. Let's go to Al. Hi, Al. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Scott and Larry. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Good morning. Yeah, my question is about cranes. I'm actually a Wisconsin boy. I just live in Minnesota because I can afford the property taxes. But this time of year, I always like to cruise out to Nisida in the east side of Black River Falls, Black River Forest, and look at cranes. But I heard the tragic news about the whooping cranes, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what happened to them and how many are left, and I'll get off the air and listen.
All right.
For people interested in watching cranes, of course, the landscape is literally inundated with sandhill cranes these days, and although they're not as perhaps as spectacular in terms of plumage or color as the white whooping cranes, they're certainly very vocal and have an interesting courtship ritual, and I kind of like to hear the sandhills this time of year. But if you're interested in the whoopers, the disaster, a fairly recent disaster that Al was referring to, was the loss of 17 of 18, all but one of the class of 07, so to speak, in terms of the whooping cranes, the juvenile whooping cranes that left Wisconsin earlier this year to make the trip to Florida for the winter. And I'm trying to remember when it was, Larry, that those severe storms hit. It wasn't much over, a couple of months ago?
Yeah, just a couple of months, yeah.
Those severe and unpredicted and unpredictable severe thunderstorms hit Florida, and they're still trying to figure out whether it was lightning or drowning or what it was. But the bottom line was virtually the entire class of 07 for the whooping crane restoration program here was wiped out. And while that was a disaster, it was unavoidable and unfortunate and a bump in the road for the program, but not much more than that. There are a number of adults now from previous year classes that have established, and the program is still going great guns and will continue to be a success. So that was literally a big bump in the road, but not catastrophic to the program. So there should be opportunity to see some of the birds from previous years where Al is looking.
And Al should, and everybody else for that matter, should know that next Wednesday I'll have Jeb Bars and Joan Garland on from the International Crane Foundation. We'll be talking sandhills and other cranes as well. That's next Wednesday at 11. So just to alert everybody to that.
On the opening day of turkey season.
On the opening of turkey season. By the way, do you know Scott Wilhelm of Altoona, Wisconsin?
I don't know him personally, but I was reading about his recent victory in the National Wild Turkey Federation's calling contest, and congratulations to Scott. If for someone who's never heard a really, really top-notch turkey caller call, it's a pretty amazing thing to observe.
It really is. I've always relied myself on the not on my own voice. But on the,
I think that's a good idea, Larry.
But on the various calls that are out there that are pretty good, and you can make pretty good likeness of a hen turkey clucking away and calling for the male to come visit. Mike in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. About 6 weeks ago, I have a strange bird in my haymow. I've never heard the call before. I can't get a glimpse of it, and he only calls around dusk or early evening. I'll try and imitate it, but I'm not very good. It sounds kind of every few minutes, and maybe the trills aren't quite as close together, but it's a low, mellow sound. Any ideas?
Sounds almost like a common pigeon to me, but...
Well, I've had a lot of pigeons in the barn, but I've never heard that sound before.
Yeah.
They coo a lot.
But right.
This is just a call like that every, maybe 5 minutes or so, and then he shuts down, or she.
Scott, what do you think?
No possibility of a barn owl, perhaps?
I don't think so.
I think, Larry, this is a case, remember the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, when you use your assistants and say, I'm going to call a friend?
Yeah.
I think in this case we might want to turn to our hundreds of thousands of listeners, many of whom are superior birders, and see if from that rendition anything strikes a chord with them.
Do it once more, Mike.
It's kind of a... But the little low sounds are further apart than I can make them. But it's not a pigeon, because I've heard hundreds of pigeons up there.
Could be an owl.
Well, let's see what we get from the listening audience, Mike. And thank you very much for that rendition.
I'll do my best.
Stay listening, Mike. Steve in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Yesterday I was out, and I came upon a deer, and it was walking away from me, and it looked very light-colored,
mm-hmm.
and I had seen piebald deer before, and I kind of expected that was what it was going to be. But when it turned broadside to me, it had spots like a fawn.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't fawn-sized. It was, and it wasn't full-sized, but it was just strange.
Hmm.
It's a little early for fawns.
Yeah, it was larger than
a
fawn.
It is very early, but actually, Larry, I found out last week while I was on campus, our deer specialist mentioned that he'd had a report that a spotted fawn had been seen already, and this was several weeks ago.
Oh.
So previously, the earliest records that I'd heard of were in April in the Madison area, which is also incredibly early since the peak of fawn drops around the 1st of June. But since it's a distribution from very early to very late, and the most there in early June, anything's possible, although it sounds like this was more the size of an adult animal.
Yeah, it was more like a yearling-sized deer.
Well,
hmm.
I suppose there could be some genetic circumstance. Well, the spotting should have been, I mean, that animal should have shed. If it was last year's deer, it should have undergone a seasonal molt to get to winter pelage and winter coloration in order to make it through the winter. I can't think of any reason how those spots would persist even as the deer was molting back. But as I say, there are so many deer and so many combinations of things that can go on. I suppose it's possible that there's one out there that for some genetic reason or perhaps abnormality did not shed its juvenile coat last year.
Oh.
I can't think of another explanation. Piebald, as you described, which is partially white, partially brown, kind of a partial albinism situation, are usually big blotches. So
yeah.
The thing looks more like a Holstein cow kind of pattern in brown and white. But if it really looked fawn-like with numerous spots, I've got to think that was some sort of an aberration or potentially a deer from a game farm. There are some, I think, fallow deer, for example, retain spots even in adult age classes. So,
well, this is definitely a whitetail.
Well, you got me then.
Okay.
maybe some of the listeners may have some experience or someone else has seen it from that area in Darlington. So.
Well, it was over by Edgerton's where I saw it.
Over by Edgerton, okay. All right, thanks, Dave.
Okay. Thanks.
We'll see what we can come up with. Helen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I read an article in the Wisconsin Outdoor News and talking about a white robin, and it said it's tough to tell if it's an albino or leucocytic, L-E-U-C-I-S-T-I-C bird.
Mm-hmm. Leucocytic.
And I was wondering what the difference is. I tried looking it up in the dictionary, and all I could get was a Greek derivative of white.
Mm. Well, there are typically, if it were a true albino, it would have lighter pink-colored eyes. But there are other conditions. In many birds, for example, if they lose a patch of feathers or are, say, squabbling with another bird and some feathers are picked out, those feathers may grow back in white. Was the bird in question completely white?
Yes, the rest of the article said, yes, it was completely white. The eyes looked dark, but some albinos do have blue eyes. Either way, robins are known to have the highest rate of pigment aberration in the bird world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had lots of reports over the years of white robins, whether they're true albinos or this other condition you're describing. I guess there's no way to know, but it's certainly not a common thing, but usually not a year goes by when there isn't a report of one or two of them. I may have to, while we get a break for the news, I'll do a Google search here on the computer of the leucocytic condition and see what they say about it, but I can't tell you much more than that.
It's more common, I believe, in reptiles than in birds. You see, especially
really?
Snakes, yeah. You see a lot of them in pet stores, sold in pet stores.
That are described as that particular...
That are described as leucocytic, yeah.
Hmm. Well, we'll see what I can come up with on the computer here, and we'll report back to you in a few minutes, Helen.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Helen, for calling. Appreciate it. Jack in Eagle River, your turn. Hi, Jack.
I wanted to see you at the library the other night in Rhinelander, but unfortunately you were competing with the final Final Four championship.
Well, Jack, it's probably a good thing you didn't come by because we had a full house. There wasn't a seat to be had, and I was expecting that people wanted to get out there and see the basketball game.
Well, that was very thoughtful. I wanted to ask you about a yearly visitor to our property about the last 3 or 4 years, comes to the same spot, digs down, and then under some more, you know, not straight down, but then like a cavern. And we're figuring it's a badger, but we didn't know if a badger would come back to the same place and do whatever he does. I assume he's going after some, maybe he's going after those little guys. Oh, I forgot what you call them.
Well, they could be after chipmunks,
all sorts
of things. Well, badgers are certainly not common, but widely spread in the state, and I suppose if one's got a home range around your area, it might make the rounds and eventually get back to dig up some chipmunks in the yard. Can you describe the? Is it a really big hole? I mean, lots of.
Well, yeah. There's quite a lot of quite a mound of dirt as a result, and I would say it's probably about a foot across and a foot up and down.
And this
about 2 square feet
close to the house.
Maybe about 30, but yeah, about 20 feet from the house, we can see it, and it's not far from where there is a. Chipmunk, but he seems to be alive and healthy.
Well, there are usually plenty of them, so one of his cousins might not be at this point.
Right.
Has this just happened recently?
You know, I can't remember if it was spring or fall, but I'm almost sure it's spring.
But
and
you
have, and then we fill it up. You know, we fill it up. We've even hosed it down a little and just to see if we could rout him out, you know, if he's still in there. But there's never any evidence of him being there except for the hole.
Well, it sounds more like you know, visitation for feeding purposes than for trying to excavate a burrow. But certainly, if you're there full time and start to see some sign of it in loose soil like that, that there should be tracks that remain evident if you can catch the activity quickly enough after it happens. There should be enough sign of some tracks that would give you an idea, and you could either take a picture of those and send them on in, or as we've talked about before in the program, there's some really good field guides out there now that help identify that kind of field sign in terms of tracks or a hair that might be left behind that could be identified by its color pattern and a couple of other options.
Well, I'll have to get out my Sherlock cap.
Get out your Sherlock Holmes equipment and see what you can find out for more information. But it could be a badger, but there's no evidence that... you know, in the spring of the year, the other things that might be digging. Are you near water?
No.
Not near water.
What else could it be, though, beside maybe a groundhog?
Well, it could be a groundhog.
Uh-huh. But
ordinarily, their digging is for purposes of opening up something they're going to live in. So it would be a deep burrow, and there's no reason for them to just come and go.
Yeah.
So it sounds more like an animal that's excavating looking for food, and badger is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
One of those situations where you set up one of those outdoor cameras,
that's another good thing. That's the use of those trail cameras, which become more sophisticated and less expensive all the time, is a really neat tool. It was an article in the Woodland Owners Association magazine last week that talked about all of the information that someone could glean from using those to determine what's on their property for wildlife and what that wildlife is up to.
Thanks again, Jack. If you'd like to join in, by the way, we've got some open lines. We'll get you on fairly fast at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Mike in Algoma next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I've got a garter snake question. Last fall, I've got a pond on my property. Last fall, I saw a garter snake basking itself, and it was near freezing.
Mm-hmm.
Then, in January, we got that hard freeze, and then we had about 4 or 5 inches of snow. I walked back to this pond again, and here I look down, and there's a garter snake that is partly in the snow and partly on top of the snow, looking dead. Well, I took it back and brought it by the house and buried under some snow to... you know, try to figure out what was going on. It was alive, and it's dead. It didn't recover. Is that? Can you explain it? Do you know what's going on?
In terms of why it was out so late in the year?
Yeah.
Well, you know, ordinarily, garter snakes and
most species will move to a hibernaculum, as it's called, which is often someone's foundation or an old well site or cistern, or maybe a natural crevice or crack in a rock formation, or a lot of other sites where they can find steady above freezing temperatures. And many snakes from an area of perhaps a few square miles or more will typically gather at the same sites, and they're very faithful to those sites from year to year. It's all we can really do is speculate at this point that perhaps the snake was en route to the hibernaculum and didn't make it, got lost the scent trail, who knows, might have been picked up by a predator and moved and not consumed, might have been in the hibernaculum and then the hibernaculum was disturbed, either someone intentionally evicting the snakes, didn't want them around. You have nearby neighbors?
No, this is in a fairly wild location.
Area? Well,
yeah.
And you don't know of any such hibernaculum in the immediate area?
No, but about 2 weeks ago, again, when it was still pretty cool, there was another snake over there. So there must be some area that they're congregating. But
there's got to be some feature there, a sinkhole or who knows what, that they're actually using as an overwinter site. And when you're dealing with as many snakes as can be in a site like that, much like the fawn drop we were talking about a couple minutes ago, there's always going to be one or two that are either out unusually early or return to the hibernaculum unusually late. Or with a thaw or a brief warm period, garter snakes in particular will emerge fairly quickly to try and take advantage of the sun. And again, one can get caught out too far by sudden snow, and that's the end of them.
Okay, but can they move when it's below zero? I mean, below freezing?
Well, not for very long.
Okay.
They have no way to maintain their body temperature. Their body temperature normally assumes a rough approximation of the air temperature, so any reptile or amphibian that's caught out in sub-freezing temperatures is not going to make it very long.
Okay.
Now, if they're the most dramatic case I've ever been involved with, and that was a call I got late one night in Madison, and I think it was in December, I want to say first or second week in December. This was a number of years ago. It was near zero. It was a very cold night. And someone called and said, there's a turtle in my window well.
Not losing you.
Someone called and said, there's a turtle in the window well here at our apartment complex. And it was near zero and late at night. So that was unusual enough that I hopped in the truck and drove over there and found the people. And sure enough, there's a turtle in the window well, and it's about 10 degrees. It was certainly moving very slowly, but it was still alive. And I took it in, and we warmed it up, and it was fine. But it turned out to be, it was a turtle called a red-eared slider, which is a southern species, certainly didn't get here on its own. It was likely someone's pet that in that apartment complex, they either moved and threw it out and said good luck to you, or it somehow escaped, as maybe a child was playing with it or something. But it certainly didn't belong there, but it wouldn't have made it through the night, I don't believe, under those cold temperatures.
What did you do with it?
Oh, I kept it for a while, and then one of our grad students was moving to Florida, and I sent it back south.
Good for you. Thanks, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Jim in Mason. Hello.
Oh, hello. Scott, I was hoping you could solve this problem I have, this question I have. Last year, I went to a little talk. A couple of Northland College students in Ashland were doing studies on earthworms in the northern forest.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, Science Friday last week, a guy from Cornell is studying earthworms in the northern forest. And what they claim is that the earthworms were extirpated when we had 2 miles of snow, ice up here 12,000 years ago and 15,000 years ago. And the earthworms haven't returned, but Europeans brought in earthworms to this area.
Mm-hmm.
Sid, are you familiar with that controversy?
Yes, I am, and it baffles me how that can be, given the fact that we find worms widely distributed. But the contention apparently is that the worms that we see now in the North Country are essentially non-native or introduced species, and the way I've heard the theory described, that these worms are gradually moving north and altering the composition of the soil and the duff layer and so forth as they go. And yet you can find worms just about anywhere you look. That maybe someone will call in and lend some credence to that, but there are several good scientific papers on the subject that I think you could probably get a hold of if you did a Google search on earthworms and see what you could find. I can't remember the name. It seems to me it was a woman who was working on this, and I can't remember her name, and I'm not at my Madison office where I can track it down. But
well, let me tell you who it is. It's,
okay, go ahead, Larry.
Because she's going to be on this show on the 18th of April, as a matter of fact, to talk about it. Cindy Hale from the University of Minnesota.
Yep, okay.
She's been researching the earthworm situation in northern forests, and we're going to have her on at 11:45 on the 18th, which would be two Wednesdays from now.
Well, let's defer then to that, and I hope that the callers really pursue that because it's a really baffling situation.
It really is. So, Jim, I hope you can tune in on the 18th.
But would you ask her if I don't get on? How do you explain the woodcocks who live all over right now are pinting and sky dancing on my farm here, that they live exclusively on, or almost exclusively on earthworms, and they've been here for a long time.
That's
correct. That's one of the aspects that causes me to wonder about this whole thing.
Well, Jim Packard helped me remember to ask that question, and we will ask that question, Jim. And if you can't hear it, you can always go to WPR.org and listen to the repeat, which you can find on our website. Let's take some more calls here. Sandy in Madison, I believe, is next. Sandy, hi to you.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Scott.
Good morning.
I'm living on the Yahara River, right between the Lake Mendota and Lake Monona,
mm-hmm.
And I'm very fortunate to be observing the life on the river every day, and I've noticed some interesting mallard behaviors. Mm-hmm. Mallards are dabblers. Mm-hmm. They sit on the surface and duck their head in and eat what they can reach.
They'll dive, too.
And I've been watching a pair of them dive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly, I first started seeing it when the ice was on the water.
Mm-hmm.
And figured they just couldn't reach anything. There wasn't anything going close enough to the surface, and they figured that out. So they do dive sometimes.
Yes, they'll dive occasionally to grab a morsel of food, but they'll also frequently dive underwater when they're being pursued. For example, when a hen is being pursued by multiple drakes and doesn't really want to deal with that kind of attention at the time, she may dive when drakes are fighting with each other. They may dive. The ducks may dive when they're, for example, wounded by a hunter and being pursued. There are a number of circumstances, but most of the birds will go underwater if they feel they need to or have to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was just mostly the male at first, and then I noticed there was a female that joined him on subsequent dates, and that just the two of them. There would be other ducks just meandering about farther away from them, but it was just the two of them having a good old time diving under and getting food.
And it's a fun thing to watch. On a more morbid side, someone was telling me about a pair of eagles that caught some ducks out in the middle of the lake, and there were small ducks and the parents. And the one of the eagles would sort of swoop down, and all the ducks would go under, and the other eagle timed its approach for the as they were coming back up, and and they picked off every one of the ducklings.
Huh.
Over they worked that area until they'd taken all seven. So, it's a rough world out there for some of those, especially ducklings.
It is.
Well, Sandy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Joan in Minocqua, we'll be coming up to you next. I just want to remind everybody, though, Scott Craven, our guest, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And now let's go on to Joan in Minocqua. Joan, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I was looking out last evening right about dusk, and I saw a kind of a rangy little animal that looked, oh, like a little dog, and except it was maybe the size of a, well, not quite a German Shepherd. It was short, smaller than that, and very thin, gray-coated, it appeared, and it kind of made a swoop through my backyard and then went on down. And I have a cat that is outside some of the time. So my questions are, you know, number one, I asked another friend who thought it might have been a coyote, and I have heard some howling, some almost soul-shattering howling during the night. So that may be possible. I presume that animal is a threat to my cat. And in the summer, I have a pond, and it kind of circled my pond. Would it go after the fish?
It's no threat to the fish. When you mentioned a gray coat, at first I was thinking a small coyote, but it could also be a gray fox, which would have looked very much the same in terms of body shape and size, but uh-huh. would have been a bit more gray than a typical coyote.
Uh-huh.
So it could be either one. The fox is the more unusual sighting, and uh-huh. I don't think the fox is much of a risk to the cat, nor
uh-huh.
and not at all to the fish.
Uh-huh.
And the coyote's probably no threat to the fish unless they're, you know, belly up on the side
right.
of the pond. They certainly might scavenge them, but
uh-huh.
not pursue them in the water. They
okay.
don't have the equipment to do that. But the coyote is a potential threat to your cat.
Cat, yeah.
But, you know, coyotes are far more widespread and common than most people realize, and
mm-hmm.
I think there's probably little you can do about the coyote, but quite a bit you can do about the cat in terms of
yeah.
how you manage the cat and how you let it out and so forth
sure.
To manage that risk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Good luck, Joan. Keep the cat inside if you can. That'd be a good thing. Bruce in Deerfield, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi. This is Bruce. Hi, Larry Scott.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a skunk that lives around my house and the neighbor's house, I guess, or two neighbors. I'm just curious if there's something I can do to either trap it or what they eat that I can try, you know, get rid of it. I let the dogs out, and once in a while you smell it, or the neighbor's dogs will kick it up. Is there anything you can do?
Well, as far as skunks are concerned, Bruce, much like the coyote we just talked about, they're pretty widespread, and it's probably unlikely that there's only a single individual. So there are a couple issues here. If the skunk is somewhere where you don't want it, in other words, under a deck, under a shed, under the porch, under the back step, something like that, then there are some things you can do structurally to screen it or build it out, assuming you can get it out or work when it is out. And you can encourage it to get out from such a confined space with some naphthalene flakes or something like that, ammonia that they don't like, that will cause them to move at least temporarily so you can make the repairs. If they just happen to be around the area, as they are around my yard, you know, we kind of grin and bear it and attempt to avoid them whenever we can. My one attempt at trapping was successful, but I didn't recognize it as a skunk until it was too late, and I got sprayed pretty well. And the dog's been sprayed a couple of times, but there are some really good products available now over-the-counter, things like Odorsol and other things that neutralize skunk odor very quickly, even the home remedy that we've talked about before using hydrogen peroxide and liquid soap and a little baking soda, and we can go over that for you if you want the details. But in any event, since there are some good products to manage the smell, whereas not too many years ago there weren't very many, a lot of people just learned to live with it. Skunks are not hard to live trap. They'll respond to pretty much any food scraps in a good-sized wire box-type live trap. But for most people, the difficulty isn't in getting them in the trap. It's what to do with
getting
them
out
after they've gotten them in the trap. Now they're not a difficult animal to deal with. They're reasonably docile, and if you approach a trap quietly with a blanket or tarp or even a big black plastic trash bag and slowly cover the trap, now mind you, this makes most people very, very nervous. But in almost all cases, you can successfully cover the trap, and once the skunk is in the dark, it can be removed from the scene and dealt with. Because they're a fairly common vector of some wildlife diseases, although I guess it's not technically illegal to take them and release them. The recommendation by the DNR and so forth is that they not be relocated. So the hope would be that if you caught a problem skunk, that it would be humanely euthanized. So the bottom line is, by the time you get into, I've got a skunk in the trap to deal with, how am I going to humanely euthanize it and deal with it and so forth, most people simply say, okay, I'm going to have a bottle of a good skunk odor removal product on hand, and if something happens, I'll deal with it. Beyond that, they're a fact of life in rural Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. Heidi in Waukesha, hello to you.
Hi. I live on a property that has a creek that runs through it and several ponds, and we've had beaver and we've had muskrats. A couple years ago, we even had river otters. But the other day, I looked out the window, and there was an animal running across the lawn toward the pond that I've never seen before, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that's a mink. But I suppose, I don't know, could it be a mink or a weasel or what? What kind of problems will it cause me?
It could have been either one, and I'd be mighty surprised if you had a creek and a couple of ponds and were in southern Wisconsin that you didn't have a mink.
Oh.
So they're reasonably common. It should have been an animal that was perhaps a couple feet long and kind of moved in loping bounds and was long and slender and chocolate brown. Does that
exactly?
Well, then it was a mink.
And, now, what does a weasel look like as opposed to the mink?
The weasel, and there are a number of different weasels, long-tailed weasel, short-tailed weasel, least weasel. A mink is a weasel by biological definition. But the weasels themselves would be, even a big one would be less than half the size of the mink.
Oh.
And the coloration would be generally lighter.
Okay.
There are certainly larger weasels, although I wouldn't expect a fisher in your area. There are weasels, member of the weasel family, even including the otters, that are bigger than the mink.
Uh-huh.
But from what you describe, I think it was a mink.
Now, do you have raised fish in those ponds?
Yeah, we have bass and bluegills.
Well, then you should now consider yourself an official mink feeder.
Will it get into my garden?
No.
Not
the least bit interested in your garden.
It'll be interested in your fish.
It'll be interested in your fish and frogs and things like that, but I don't really think in a well-managed bass and bluegill system where there are probably lots of bluegills, I don't think you're ever going to notice any difference.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Jim in Bayfield County, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. I have a question about lead shot. I'm one of the delegates from Bayfield County in the Conservation Congress, and one of the questions this coming, I think it's the 16th at the hearings, is has to do with prohibiting the use of lead shot for upland game birds on DNR property.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to have you just spend a moment talking about that, but my real question here, if this is a good rule,
mm-hmm.
why is it just DNR property? Why isn't it a statewide rule, just like lead shot is prohibited statewide for ducks? Also, a note here, the Shawamigan-Nicolet Forest has banned lead shot for several years, and I think most people don't know about that.
I don't think many people do, and the part of the problem, Jim, is that, of course, lead is historically widely used. It's relatively inexpensive. It's what every hunter has dozens of boxes of lying around in their gun cases and cabinets and whatnot. And you have to remember back when the lead shot ban was made for waterfowl hunting, this was a really divisive and controversial thing. But people got used to it, and it's not viewed as an issue anymore. And as a conservation strategy, it was the right thing to do, and it's probably saved millions of waterfowl over time. The use in upland sites is a little harder for people, I think, to get their mind around in terms of what the problems are. But certainly lead deposition, if it's picked up in wounded or escaped animals by various predators, especially birds, then there can be some problems with lead poisoning, even in a non-aquatic setting. Last night I was reading an interesting study. At the same time this is going on here, there are debates, particularly in the West, to ban lead not in shot shells, but in rifle bullets.
Oh.
And that's a major That's a really major leap in terms of lead. And the issue there is particularly in areas where large numbers of prairie dogs, ground squirrels, things like that are shot, you know, more for varmint control or target practice. I would have thought that a rifle bullet would pass right through a prairie dog or ground squirrel and there'd be no bullet remains to deal with. But in fact, a number of studies have been done to show that an expandable bullet, lead bullet, even a jacketed lead bullet, will leave quite a substantial amount of lead fragments in even a prairie dog carcass. And then as eagles or other raptors or whatnot scavenge on these, or in the case of California, the California condors scavenge on these ground squirrels, they're picking up significant doses of lead, and it's a big problem.
You know, and at this point, Scott, save the rest of your thoughts. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here. And we'll take up that topic of lead and certainly answer your questions as well right after a look at the news. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. And Scott, we were talking with Jim in Bayfield County before our news break about the Wisconsin Conservation Congress hearings. One of the questions dealing with banning of lead shot on DNR lands.
Yes, and I guess the first thing I'd like to mention, since we haven't brought it up yet on the program today, is that coming up on April 16th, a couple Mondays, is the typical date for the spring hearings, the Conservation Congress hearings. Those take place in every county, and it's a terrific opportunity for anybody and everybody to go to the hearings and be able to speak their mind on whatever wildlife or fisheries issues come before the Congress hearing. So given that plug, one of the issues apparently is this lead shot ban on DNR properties on upland sites. I don't know much of the background for that. We were talking a little bit about how even with lead rifle bullets, let alone lead shotgun pellets, there is still, even in upland sites, some risk of lead poisoning to scavengers or predators that may pick up animals or the shot directly that have been escaped, crippled, wounded, dead, dying, left behind, whatever. So I suspect that must be the rationale. I guess I'm not familiar enough with the data that would be presented at the spring hearing to suggest that this is enough of an issue to warrant the ban in upland hunting. I suspect that the objections from hunters are going to stem mainly from the fact that the other shot alternatives have different ballistics, different costs associated with them, the same kinds of arguments we heard when the lead shot ban came into play in wetland sites. So I don't know where that's headed. I think Jim's original question was, if this is a good idea on state lands, is it not a good idea perhaps statewide or on all lands? And I guess logic would dictate that that's the case, but I suspect that that's going to be an uphill battle, especially when you start to talk about things like game farms where pheasants are hunted and assorted other things. So, see what happens on the 16th. I suspect if this issue gets some legs under it, then there'll be a lot of related issue articles or stories or exposés in things like Outdoor News and other such publications.
Yeah.
And, Larry, if I can just interject, I use the news to do a little bit of Google work.
Oh.
And first of all, when you Google albino robins, you will find out that albino robins are primarily, most albino robins are actually partial albinos and have eye pigment. But true albinos with no eye pigment are also possible and seen with some regularity. About 1 in 30,000 robins, according to this website, are actually either albino or partial albino, more than any other bird species in North America. In fact, about 8% of all albino birds observed in North America are robins, yet there are hundreds of other species. So anyway, there's more than you ever wanted to know about albino robins available on the Internet, but I can find absolutely no mention of a leukocytic condition that results in white robins or any other bird. And when you try and Google leukocytic, you get hundreds and hundreds of medical records and so forth, but I can find no record relating to birds or reptiles in terms of what that means. So we're going to have to go to a technical expert to get some advice on that.
I do. I also went online and found some photos of some leucocytic red-winged blackbirds. Some great photos
Did it say anything about what the leucocytic condition really means?
I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet.
Leucocytic relates to white blood cells.
Right.
And yet the blood cells should have nothing to do with the pigmentation of the feathers.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That one's a mystery to me. We'll see what shakes out here.
Mary and Danbury, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Scott and Larry.
Hi.
I've got a question about gray jays. We're about 60 miles south of Superior, and we've lived here about 20 years, and our neighbor all of his life, and he's about 70, and neither of us have ever seen a gray jay here. Yet this winter, from early December to mid-March, we had two gray jays here that entire time. And so my questions are, what is their natural food? Do they mate long-term, so possibly it was a pair rather than just two of one species? And then what in the world were they doing this far south?
Well, what county are you in?
Burnett.
Burnett. Well, it's really not that far south. I had a good friend who for many years near Fifield, just west of where I am now in Minocqua in Price County, which isn't too much latitudinally different from where you are, had gray jays every winter and in large numbers.
In fact,
they were his gray jays. Other people know them as whiskey jacks. They look something like a smallish blue jay, but are gray in color, and they're a very pretty bird and noted for being rather tame and curious and so forth. So a neat bird to have around. And this fellow used to attract them and feed them quarter-pound sticks of margarine. I don't know if that was the best thing for the gray jays, but he would wait until margarine was on sale at the grocery store when you could get 4 pounds for a dollar or something and put 50 pounds in his freezer, and he made little wire feeders that he could just slide a frozen stick of margarine in, and he claimed the gray jays just went nuts over that, and he had them every winter. So they are around in the northern part of the state, but they're not especially common. I can't give you some of the chapter and verse of their breeding behavior or whether you likely had a pair or not. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you had a pair, if they were too present. But if you, much like we've been using the Internet here to try and find some information on the albino robins, if you go to the eBird website and type in gray jay, you will get every shred of information you could ever hope to have in terms of their distribution, comings and goings, and breeding behavior. And you could accomplish, if you don't have access to the Internet, you could do the same thing in a good field guide. Okay?
All right. Thank you very, very much for calling. Martin in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Hello. We have a large squirrel population in this remnant Maple Beach woods that I manage, and at certain seasons, not certain seasons, in certain years, we'll get busy squirrels, and they cannot stand upright and feed. They'll end up falling over like drunken sailors or whatever, and one was even, I don't know if it was smart enough or opportunistic enough, it just leaned up against the trunk where the bird feeder was so it wouldn't fall over while it ate. They seem to disappear when we have a large feral cat population. Now that the feral cat population is down, one showed up again this past week, stood up, ate something off the ground. The longer it stood on its hind legs, the more it went upright with its head and finally just fell over.
And what time of year do you see these strange
all
behaviors?
All year.
Okay. So it has nothing to do with fall feeding on fermented fruits and that kind of thing, which does cause some very strange behavior in some animals. But ordinarily, I think when squirrels seem to be disoriented like that or their sense of balance is affected, I think the usual explanation, although there are probably many things, that there's some type of a parasitic infection or something that's affected their balance. So it's either parasite or disease, and if that debilitates them to the point that they're either more vulnerable to cats or other predators or more vulnerable to being run over in the road, then that I expect eventually thins them out, and whatever the affected whatever the cause is, disappears for a period until there's enough squirrels or a population rebuilt to the extent that it can express itself again.
Interesting. Thank you very much for calling, Marty. And on to Alan in Milwaukee. Hi, Alan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I'm calling this morning is because I woke up this morning, 6:30, to a kind of an intermittent scratching or gnawing sound that was echoing from the ductwork in my home. Mm-hmm. And I can't figure out if there's actually anything in there or not, but it was coming from somewhere, and I was wondering if maybe you or your guest are familiar with this kind of thing, what it could be, if anything, and how it might have gotten in, how I might get it out.
Well,
there's different.
The sad reality here, Alan, is that there are a whole host of animals that could be inside a building and be doing some scratching or gnawing that you would be able to hear that might cause some concern. If it sounded like it was truly in the ductwork, then the more likely explanation is that something is somehow, perhaps a bird, coming down through a chimney or flue or damper or whatnot, has gotten into the system and is scratching around trying to get out. It's also possible there are a whole host of different squirrels, bats, raccoons, chipmunks, flying squirrels, rats, mice. There are a whole host of animals that could easily be in a building, in the wall voids, in the attic, in the space between floors, and perhaps be either on or close to or near enough to the ductwork that you might interpret their scratching or movement that it was in the ductwork. It could be either one. And frankly, the only way you're going to get to the bottom of it is to probably have a pest control person come in and do something of an inspection to see what they can find in terms of droppings or hairs or other sign or even hear the sound themselves.
Yeah, and if you've got, say, a vents that vent to the outside walls and you don't have a covering over those vents, if it's just a little flapper kind of situation.
Are you thinking about those sparrows next to your house, Larry?
Right. Yeah. The neighbors, the birds use the neighbor's vent there for nesting. And they've
learned to lift the louvers.
They lift the louvers and go right on in.
Yeah.
And I laughed about it until this spring I noticed that the covering that I had on my vent up on the second floor had somehow gotten loose, and now I have some in my vent up in the on the second floor, which I'm going to have to get out in the next week.
And so that's true. That's another possibility, is that even if you're if a vent, a dryer vent, or a stove vent, or something like that has a cover on it, some birds and some rodents are quite capable of penetrating that defense and getting into the system.
Yep, absolutely.
And I'd certainly check those kinds of things first.
Yeah.
See if something's loose or propped open, or just watch for some sign or some dirt or a feather or a hair on the vent that suggests that things are coming and going. And if you find something like that, that's actually the good news, because you can fix that and prevent them from getting in, and it probably means you don't have some sort of an infestation in the house.
Hope for that, Alan.
Hope for that one.
Thank you for calling. Bob in Woodruff, hello to you.
Yeah, pretty good.
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Just a couple observations and then your guest thoughts on this. Calling about the possible presence of mountain lions in northern Wisconsin. Now, I understand that the DNR has a large team of volunteers that regularly goes out and walks logging roads after snowfalls and keeps tracks of predators, populations, and everything by their tracks. Mm-hmm. So they're out there a lot. And I see a lot of bogus pictures on the Internet of mountain lions. Either they were trumped or they were taken in the western states. So the DNR's opinion really is no one's shown them proof that there's a mountain lion in the area ever. But I talk to so many people or hear about so many people that are credible people, and it's hard to miss an animal that size with a 4-foot-long tail
mm-hmm.
crossing in front of you. What's your take on it? Do you think these people really are seeing a mountain lion or not? And I'll take my question. I'll hang up.
Yes, I have no doubt any longer that some of these sightings, and because of the number of credible people involved and the sincerity of their observations, even without tracks or photographs, yes, there are mountain lion sightings and valid records. And there's a faculty colleague of mine at Stevens Point who's working with his students to assemble all this information, and they've actually published and printed some very nice maps suggesting where the hot spots are for sightings in the state, and this is a precursor to a mountain lion management plan if and when that ever becomes appropriate. So I think most people, as you suggest, there are thousands of miles driven and walked during the winter track surveys, and mountain lion records have not surfaced, but it's a big state. There are a lot of areas that are back off the beaten path, so to speak, and so there are some animals out there. So where did they come from? What I'm fairly certain they're not is a remnant population from the days when we had an acknowledged population of mountain lions, but that was over a century ago. So they've either moved into the state on their own, which is quite possible. A couple of years ago, there was a radio-marked lion from way out in western South Dakota that was tracked all the way across South Dakota, most of the way across Minnesota. It was still headed toward Wisconsin. I don't know what became of that one, but they can cover tremendous distances. So it's possible that some have moved in on their own. And they're also an animal, as we've talked about before, that's widely held in captivity. And I'm sure that the origin of some of the lions around the state is either escaped or released animals that had human-assisted origins. And again, there's the possibility that they moved in from other places. So bottom line, Bob, yes, I think most people acknowledge that there are some valid sightings around the state, but there's still no evidence that we have what you'd call a self-sustaining or reproducing population. But there certainly are some records, recent records, current records of mountain lions seen.
Thanks again for calling. Tom in Green Bay, hello to you.
Hi there. Some information about leucistic animals is exactly the opposite of melanistic.
Okay.
And there has been a long debate, especially in ornithology, whether to call birds partial albinos or whether they're leucistic.
Okay.
Simply because a true albino will have the pink eye. There's usually some other things. Some people consider albinism a total. In other words, you can't have a partial. And dealing with some other orders, such as like in herps, classes such as herps, amphibians, and reptiles, they won't use the term partial albino. They refer to it as being leucistic if it's got white pigmentation but it's not a total true animal.
So this is a case where it's a lack of pigmentation
This can be a few feathers. It could be the entire bird except for the legs and the beak and the eyes and the soft parts around the cere. Or it could just be a single feather on a wing. And the question is whether you want to call that leucistic or whether a lack of pigment, okay, or whether you want to call it albinism.
So it's
But some geneticists refer to albinism as being total. You can't be partial. You either are or you aren't.
Right. That makes sense. So this is a lack of pigment condition that has nothing to do with the genetic condition of albinism. And furthermore, it has nothing then to do with the biological term leukocytic, which refers to white blood cells. There's nothing to do with that at all.
No.
Okay.
No. And the interesting thing is you can have individuals also where you have, which also referred to as leucistic, where you have their tan rather than white.
Oh.
In other words, that real faded color. I've seen crows where you can actually see barring in the flight feathers, which you would never see, when they're totally black. But they're actually, in it. And the other interesting thing is apparently this can change from year to year and from one plumage change to the other. Some of those feathers may be white. They may not be white the next year.
Hmm. Interesting.
Versus a true albino, which has all of the aspects of being albinistic.
Right. Well, thank you very much,
Tom,
for clearing that up here at the 11th hour in our program. I wouldn't have slept tonight not knowing about that.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it very much. Well, Alice in Wind Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Alice.
Yes, good morning or good afternoon. Regarding suet feeders,
mm-hmm.
It always drives me nuts when the blackbirds and cowbirds are chowing down my suet. So my husband was nice enough to make a wooden feeder that would hold four suet cakes, and they lay flat.
Mm-hmm.
And underneath it is hardware cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, those things have figured out how they can hang on there and chew away on the suet. So I'm wondering if you have come across any other design, or if there's, I was thinking if there was a way to kind of make the suet farther from them, like put another layer of hardware cloth or something. Have you ever come across that where you want to improve that design to make it so just the woodpeckers and, you know, the other birds can eat that?
Mm.
Boy, that's a tough one. I give most of the birds and squirrels and so forth a lot of credit. If there's a food source available, they're going to figure out a way to exploit it. And the blackbirds and so forth who are, you know, here seasonally as opposed to the woodpeckers and other things that you want to feed the suet to, the short answer is no. I've not seen any brilliant design that produces a suet feeder that will allow access to the nuthatches and woodpeckers and things that you normally want to see at a suet feeder and yet prevent access by blackbirds.
Yeah, it's pretty much impossible. I mean, I suppose for the smallest birds, you could build a feeder that where they would have to enter through a hole to get through it, but
that's going to exclude your woodpeckers.
That excludes the woodpeckers. So, sorry, Alice.
But Alice, you know, here's a tremendous opportunity. You get your husband back out there in the shop, and if he can design something for you that works,
yep.
You're going to be very wealthy.
You're going to make a lot of money.
Kill crabgrass, but not the grass. Or
that, yeah. Too. There are lots of things for your husband to work on.
Yeah. Get him out there right now. And thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, George and Madison, you're next. Hi, George. George, are you there? I think we lost George. Let's go to Jenny and Tomahawk. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that today I have a flock of junco, a bunch of goldfinches, and three robins. And the robins are sitting on the end of a very, very tip end of a pine tree eating seeds or insects or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so far out on the end of it, they have a hard time balancing, and the branches going up, and they have to spread their wings every once in a while just to stay on.
Well, Scott?
Well, it's as I said when we started the program, it's particularly here in the North Country where we've had a resurgence of winter, it's a great day for bird feeders. And throughout the program, I've been watching what's been coming and going, and I've probably had six or seven different species here while we've been talking. So it's a chance. This is a great time of year with the birds really just starting to come through in big waves to see all sorts of things. And, of course, when there's a bit of a setback in the weather, then they've got to struggle a bit. But the whole system works pretty well. They'll be fine. They'll find something to eat, and another season will be in the books.
And the Wisconsin Bluebird Association is a good place to go for more information about bluebirds. Someone called in. They're online, and certainly it's a great place to go for information. Scott, get out there and shovel some snow.
I'm going to let it melt.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. And I'm pleased to have him along, and he'll be back the first Wednesday of next month to do this again. Don't forget, we'll be talking about those earthworms on April 18th with Cindy Hale of the University of Minnesota. And next Wednesday, we'll be talking about cranes. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.